Welcome to Software Gone Wild, this time focused on building your own gear. It all started with one of my blog posts, as usual, where I said, well, don't think you can be Google or something like that and build your own stuff, because you need a large team and engineers who know what they're doing for that. And as always, when I make a black and white statement, I was wrong. A few hours later, I got this lengthy comment from Giacomo Bernardi saying, well, you know what? We did it. So I said, well, we have to record a podcast about that. And today with me is Giacomo. How are you doing?
Hi, Ivan. Thank you for letting me in this podcast.
And keeping me honest is another engineer with production OpenFlow experience, Nick Braglio. Nick, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. Glad to be here. Very excited about this one.
Excited about someone who built his own OpenFlow stuff.
I'm just excited about anybody that can run what they're running with the resources that they're running it with. And on top of that, be innovative. That's hard.
So, Giacomo, what did you do?
Well, hello, everyone. And let me start with a little disclaimer. Everything I was referring to on that comment on your blog was for the stuff we built for a company in Italy called Eolo. That is basically an internet service provider covering most of the country. And since a few weeks ago, actually, I'm not affiliated anymore with that company, but that's fine for this podcast. I moved on and now I'm working for an hardware vendor.
So at that time, you were working for a service provider.
Yeah.
Business services or residential services?
Yeah, so basically Eolo is a countrywide service provider covering most of Italy. Actually, I've been there for 14 years in total, so for a very long time. I started when we were still a 12-people startup, and when I left, we were almost 300 people. So, you know, the whole process of scaling up a network. Right now, they cover both the residential segment and also business customers. I should note that this is a mostly fixed wireless access provider, which means basically that they have almost 2,000 towers, radio towers, scattered across the country. And each customer gets basically a small radio to install, typically on the roof or on a balcony or anyway outdoor. So it's not a cable or DSL traditional ISP.
It's one of those providers where I don't need any infrastructure apart from the dish on the roof to get internet access.
Yes, correct.
And I know that there are people doing some crazy stuff with this wireless thingies. I know someone in Slovenia who was building open source meshed wireless networks from Linksys routers. So what were you guys doing?
Well, we were using for the radio tier a number of protocols. We used WiMAX earlier on in the days. Right now we are using a proprietary technology that we developed with Cambium Networks. And basically, just to give you a scale of this network, we now have around 2,000 towers, around 200K customers all across the country. And we are talking about mostly customers located in suburban regions or, you know, mountain countryside, all these very hard to serve places, basically.
Yeah, that's one of the things that the wireless last mile providers tend to be very good at. They're working with very difficult to reach constituency. And so they tend to be very innovative in how their networks are built, the gear that they're willing to hack around with and work on. And I've built a couple of WISPs in previous lives, and there's always interesting challenges that come along with that. So when I saw that this was primarily a last mile wireless solution, I wasn't really that surprised because of those things. But running 1,000 YPOPs is difficult even when you're using traditional gear. So what you're doing with automation, I think, is very interesting.
Yeah, so basically, let me give you a bit of motivation why we decided to go for our own gear, because that's really has to do a lot with the history of how we grew up. Basically, we started with a small number of towers across the company headquarters, basically, but we were offering a service which is comparable to typical DSL or cable, basically, up to 30 megs right now. And the customer take-up was very fast, so we outgrown our network. And at the beginning, we were just a very simple layer to bridging with the customer over PPP, you know, a very traditional European ISP kind of architecture. We started having a desperately large layer 2 network, and that was growing scary, as you can understand. So at some point, we decided we had to refactor the whole network. But as you know, you have to do that while you are in production. That's not that easy. So we decided to do an RFP and contact a few of the very well-known vendors, let's say. We basically look at the solution they suggested. All of them were very similar. We are talking about, I think, 2012, 2013, so a few years ago. And all the solutions we got back were very similar. They were all based on some sort of either segment routing or pseudo wires on top of traditional IGP, or I think it was OSPF. And that is probably fine, except that in our network, we are mostly using wireless point-to-point links for backhauling. So, you know, multi-gigabit wireless link to connect radio towers between them and provide some sort of backhauling to one or more data centers. And because of the fact that we used wireless link everywhere, our backhauling looked like a real dense mesh. We really outgrown the connectivity between towers. So at some point, we calculated that from each of these radio towers, we had more than 2.2 links to the backhaul on average. So if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, effectively, you had pretty random partial mesh with unequal cost links.
Absolutely, yes.
Which is like the worst possible scenario for any routing protocol.
Exactly. So the question was, we have this great asset all over the country of having links everywhere, which is great for redundancy in theory, but how do you exploit them? How do you leverage them with traditional routing?
Oh, you buy the North Star controller from Juniper.
Juniper, yeah. Which I believe it automatically spawns an equal cost path and deploys on all the routers, right?
No. And then you build multiple tunnels between any two endpoints.
Yeah, this is what I meant.
Yeah.
Ugh. So basically what you ran into was the typical growing pain associated with a successful service provider, right? You ran into layer two scaling issues, which everyone eventually sees, and you ran into the problem of full mesh manageability.
Yes.
And so you were looking at typical solutions for that, but then decided to look further than that?
Yes. Yeah. Basically, the first wall we would hit would be the scalability in number of MAC addresses, and also the fact that we would have a single broadcast domain across the whole country. So can you imagine that? That would be seriously a nightmare.
Yeah, I don't want to imagine that at all.
No, I know a few countries that melted down when using this approach, so yeah.
Had you to do with any of them?
No.
Okay. So we wanted to restructure the whole network, but we didn't know what was the best way to leverage this unequal cost path we had all over the place. So we started having crazy ideas. So ideas of basically developing an algorithm or join the OpenFlow movement or the SDN movement with a central controller that has the topology of the whole network and exploit this knowledge in order to algorithmically find the optimal forwarding set that would basically reduce the number of oversaturated links. That was the idea we had. But then the question is, how do you do it in practice? Over a network where you don't have any side channel, because this router, they are installed on radio towers, they may be in mountains or very remote locations where you really don't want to send a field engineer to restart or with a serial console. How do you do that? Is any of these controllers mature enough to scale this size? That was the question we had a few years ago. And at the time, I think the answer was, well, not really.
No, I think the answer is still, well, not really.
Yeah, I'll agree with that.
The other problem is, as you said, because you don't have a reliable side channel that you could use for control plane, OpenFlow is not the answer.
Exactly. So we had to go through, let's say, an hybrid rollout, having some potentially rock solid old school routing for management, and then on top an SDN technology of some sort to forward the traffic on an arbitrary way. That could be MPLS, could be segment routing, could be OpenFlow based rules, could be anything, but just something that would be controlled arbitrarily from a central authority. That was the idea.
So you would use this mesh with traditional routing protocol just to get connectivity for the control and management plane. And then you would use whatever paths you would think are optimal at the moment to forward the actual user traffic.
Exactly. Exactly. So we would always have, let's say, a last-ditch solution to reach remote routers over, I don't know, SSH or over SNMP or something to restart them or to do emergency procedures, basically.
Were you able to get any gear that would support something like this?
Yeah, that was the first barrier we hit. So basically, we are doing a rollout in production while the network is running, and we are actually installing like 100 new towers per month. So it has to be a smooth deployment. And we looked around and we really couldn't find anything that would allow us that bit of flexibility needed to have hybrid rollout, as I explained. So between us, we decided, well, why don't we actually build something? And our inspiration, to be honest, was the open compute movement from Facebook. That year, I think they didn't have yet the networking track, which started later on. But we were basically wondering, people are doing this with servers. So they are designing custom servers for large-scale data center all over the world, and they are stripped-down server without PSU, without a UPS, a specific number of cores, those specs that will bring up the efficiency of the deployment. Why cannot we do that? Why does networking have to be so different from computing, for example? This was the idea we had in mind. And I started to look around to see if there was a simple CPU architecture that we could exploit, that we could use. The first naive idea was building a box based on x86, so some sort of traditional motherboard with some number of interfaces and RAM and disk and all that stuff. But keep in mind that these boxes are to be installed in location where power is expensive, where every watt of power has to be made redundant because the electricity supply is not stable at all in these remote locations. We had very strict power requirements. We wanted to be, let's say, below 100 watts in every location, which is not that much if you think about it. And it's definitely not enough for an x86-based application. I was looking at system-on-a-chip solutions, and let me stress, I don't have that much of an hardware background. I'm mostly a software developer or a network person as a background. But I was looking at the various system-on-a-chip architecture, and I found this exotic architecture from a company that at the time was called Tailera, and that then was acquired by EasyChip, and it's now currently part of the Mellanox Corporation. This architecture is basically many core CPU. So it's a single piece of silicon with up to 72 cores, with on-chip up to, I think, 8 10 gigabit interfaces. So the MAC layer of 8 10 gigabit interfaces, which you can split up in multiple gigabit, and also multiple RAM controllers and so on. So it was an architecture that I think I would be able to design something directly on. So we decided to look around for an OEM, so basically a manufacturer that would help us to do the hardware design and to build a few prototypes. And at the end, we signed an agreement with an OEM to build a few thousand of these devices. Because of the company color is blue, we decided to basically paint them blue. So everyone would see them, we would understand that this is a custom piece of hardware that was built by ourselves. So a bit of identity as well.
By the way, while you were explaining this, I remember this, is it Latvian or Lithuanian company, Microtik?
Yes, exactly. Latvian.
Latvian, okay. And they also use a third-party hardware for the routers from Routerboard. Did you look at them?
Yes, exactly. Microtik is, to be honest, I loved Microtik gear. Although people in networking always point at them as the very low-end people or the very low-end stuff just because they are cheap. They have several interesting solutions. And one of them is based on this exact same CPU that at the end we decided to go for, the Tailera CPU. Mm-hmm. Of course, on the Microtik gear, you cannot install anything yourself. You just have to use their own operating system, which is great, but it wasn't flexible enough for our solution, basically.
Yeah, the Microtik stuff is extremely popular in the WISP market, you know, in that corner of networking. I mean, frankly, I love the gear. I'm plugged into one right now. I've got a whole bunch of it. It's extremely flexible from a perspective of feature per dollar. But you're right, you can't modify the operating system. They've got their own sort of operating environment that's Linux-based, and you can't install plugins or anything like that with it.
Exactly, yeah.
So the things I'm looking at routerboard.com are not generic hardware where you could put Linux on it, but you have to go with MikroTik operating system.
That's been my experience with them. I don't know if there are ways around that or not, but frankly, when you can buy a $25 four-port switch that'll run MPLS, I never really needed to do that. But it is merchant-based chips, I believe, that are custom-built for their specific hardware line.
Yeah, high-end seems to be Telera.
Yes, they have a family on Telera, other families on MIPS. And they're great pieces of hardware. I mean, it's a no-brainer if you want something cheap that supports, for example, MPLS, in my opinion. But you must run their software on them. So we wanted to have something a bit more flexible than that. And also, because we needed to connect a number of radio heads, basically, on the towers, we needed quite peculiar port count. So we decided to go for 24 gigabit interfaces and 210 gigabit at the moment. And that's the port mix we decided for, of which 8 are SFP and the rest is copper.
So you would use the 10 gig uplinks probably for connective for the backhaul and the 1 gig ports toward the customers, right?
Most of the time, yes.
And what software are you running on this gear then?
Let me go back a minute. And at the end, we managed to find an agreement with an OEM that would be willing to build such a small volume, so just a few hundred units to start.
Oh, yeah, just a few thousand, yeah.
Yeah, a few hundred to start scaling up to a couple of thousands. Then we had to test, basically, this couple of prototypes. So you imagine like a Christmas morning gift when you open the package and you find your router you have been working on for a few months before. So you have that prototype in your lab, you boot it up, you do a couple of things, but then we really wanted to make sure that it would work in this harsh environment where it would be installed. So we basically, without much experience of hardware or testing, we decided to hire a lab facility, a testing facility in Italy. And we went through multiple testing in a climate chamber to test that it would perform error-free over a range that was between minus 15 Celsius and plus 75, which is quite an extended temperature range for networking gear.
Oh, so you actually froze and baked the gear?
Multiple times, yes, over multiple days. That was really fun.
That's cool.
Cool and hot at the same time.
Exactly.
Also, keep in mind that these boxes are, they are not in data centers. I mean, they go into telecommunication shelters that sometimes they are just a piece of junk. They may not have any air conditioning whatsoever. They may not even have a fan sometimes to move air around. So we really wanted to make sure that the temperature of up to 70, 80 Celsius would be fine for this gear.
And they are sitting next to a radio tower.
Exactly. So there is a very strong electromagnetic field sometimes in these locations. So we basically wanted to make sure that our gear would comply with a very exotic IEEE regulation, which basically states that an hardware device should operate error-free when it is installed within an electromagnetic field of a given strength. So we basically moved our gear to an anechoic chamber, so to a chamber where we irradiated it with RF energy at different frequencies, at different polarization, from different angles, and so on. And this took days to do. But at the end, we managed to have a very solid piece of hardware, so we never managed to make it crash, basically.
Wow.
So you're saying that you actually tested this for RF interference as well as for environmental temperatures on the hot and cold side? And
Yep. Excellent.
That's one of the really difficult things to deal with a WISP is all of the RF interference, especially if you're putting your gear on towers that are AM or FM radio or ham radio towers that may not be your own. There's all kinds of bleeding RF everywhere. And the fact that you tested for that is a testament, right? And even better that it didn't fail.
Yeah, exactly. And you have no control whatsoever once you are in these locations. We meet every kind of wireless ISPs. We are, a quite peculiar one. We are probably one of the largest wireless ISPs in the world, at least on unlicensed spectrum. And we really wanted to make sure these devices would operate everywhere. Actually, I gave an early talk about this router in RIPE 69. So if you want to see some pictures of this testing in this climate chamber and anechoic rooms, there are some pictures in that talk. And I invite you to have a look if you want.
Yeah, I'm looking at those pictures right now and they're impressive.
It was a lot of fun. And as I said, none of us had any hardware experience. So it was a lot of learning involved.
Yeah, but the takeaway I'm getting from this is that people talk about, oh, you're building your own gear, and a lot of time is focused on what's the operating system, what's the feature support list, what's the port count or whatever. And what isn't really being discussed is all of the things that you just said. There's a whole lot of things that go into making equipment that are above and beyond what the features are and what the port count is. It's how is it going to react when it gets below freezing? You know, what's going to happen if somebody turns on a ham radio transceiver that's literally on top of it? Those are things that are not often discussed, and they're critically important when it comes to running a production service.
Exactly.
If I want to go down that same path, could I buy that hardware?
In a way, you can, by contacting, for example, this merchant ship vendor that we used. They will probably point you out to some OEM that they work with. And then it's just a matter of deciding for your own port count or specification and sizes and so on. But let me stress, it's quite a lengthy process. And also, you will have to build a few thousand of devices, of course. They won't do a batch of 50 or 100 of them.
Of course.
I mean, they will, but the setup cost will just be impossible.
Yeah, it's really a shame that you guys didn't do something like Facebook and just open source the design so that anyone could go and tell the OEMs, well, build me 1,000 of these, please, according to this spec.
Yes, at the moment, the networking group in the Open Compute project, it's only about switches, basically. You know, the six-pack, the wedge, all these great, mostly Broadcom-based chipset at the moment. But there isn't much for layer 3 and above, let's say traditional routing. And I really wish this would change soon, because especially in the telco world, I believe there would be space for that.
Moving forward to software that runs on this stuff, what did you put on top of it?
Exactly. So we had this great piece of hardware, and now it was the time to have some software run on top of it. So the first naive idea was, of course, we'll install Linux. How hard can it be? Yeah, it's a rhetorical question, of course. I mean, it could run very easily, but in the networking stack in Linux, it's great. It's the de facto standard for a huge number of protocols. And it astonishes me every time I look at the kernel, because there are, at the moment, 16 different TCP congestion control algorithms.
Yeah.
And that's really a huge implementation of anything related to networking. But at the same time, the Linux kernel networking stuff has scalability issues. So it cannot be run completely in parallel. There are some functions which still depend on syscalls, or they still depend on single thread execution. So even if you have a many core architecture like we do, it wouldn't scale linearly with a number of cores. So this is why there is this trend in the industry of designing user level networking stacks. So for example, in the Intel world, there is the great DPDK implementation, which is open source. You can scale that linearly with a number of core, and it's a great high performance implementation. But we wanted to get something that would support, first of all, MPLS and OpenFlow, let's say. Also something that would run on multiple architectures, not only on x86, so that if later on we decide to move to a different architecture, to leave that layer and move to, I don't know, someone else that will come up in time, we would be able to, without having to rewrite completely the whole software stack. So at the end, we decided to go with a great user space stack that we licensed from a company that is called Sixwind. Mm-hmm. They are a French company. They build basically a networking stack for typically network appliance vendors or hardware vendors, basically, that can be used as a wireframe or as a blueprint to build things on. So basically, we licensed the source code for a networking stack that was running natively on Telera, on x86, on a number of platforms. What they give you is basically a user space binary that you can run in multiple execution, basically one per core. And in this particular architecture we used on the Telera, you have a small programmable FPGA in front of the CPU, which you can use to sort of hash incoming packets and send them to one specific core of the main you have, let's say, based on some provided hash function you've write. So the idea in our setup is that you have 72 cores. We keep 8 of them at the moment for the Linux scheduler. so that we run all the control plane daemons on these 8 CPUs. And the rest we just assign statically 2 cores for each gigabit interfaces and 8 cores for each 10 gigabit interface. And all the execution, all the pipeline is done on the egress port, basically. So when a packet comes in, it goes to a given core. And on that core, there is a static binary running and including the whole networking stack. So the Ethernet switching, the MPLS lookup, maybe L3 lookup, and so on. So as you understand, it is a much more deterministic way of handling traffic than using the Linux kernel, of course.
Every interface card would be tied to one or a set of cores.
Yes.
And those cores would scan the input queue of the interface card and do the lookup and send the packet to the output queue of some other interface.
Yes, exactly. Basically, it's as you described.
And these cores are inaccessible to Linux, so Linux can never run anything on them.
Unless you explicitly decide to, yes.
Presumably, you're taking this, so that's the standard build of your network operating system. That's not manually configured for every single device, is that correct?
Yes, that's overall for all the devices we have.
Okay. And then if you decide that you want to go and change some of those parameters, those are just tunables within your network operating system that you can change manually if you want to.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Okay.
We decided also to have, in these routers, we have an SSD storage, and we also have a small flash memory where we basically store multiple copies of the operating system. So, for example, on each box, we keep, the last 2 images. So in case anything should fail on the current image, the router will self-reboot itself using an hardware watchdog and try restarting using the previous firmware. We are desperately trying to avoid a situation where we have to send a network engineer to the site. So even
right.
Booting up with a previous image is better than not booting up at all.
So you're using typical standard networking best practices when it comes to doing software loads and things like that. You have your primary boot image, your secondary boot image. A lot of that, to me, just seems like really normal best practices stuff, but you're doing it in a on your own.
Exactly, yes. You are reinventing the wheel in a way.
Yeah. I mean, not really. I mean, you're reusing tools that are known to be good.
Yeah.
Going back to the packet forwarding, you said that the binary does lookups, it looks up MAC addresses, IP addresses, and so on. How do you configure the forwarding process? Does it look up the Linux routing and bridging tables, or can you do anything else?
Yes, that's a good question. Ideally, the forwarding table, I mean both L2, L3, the MPLS hashes, and so on, they are synchronized between the user space and the Linux kernel. For example, if you decide to handle the layer 3 routing table using Quagga, for example, they will be synchronized between the kernel fib and the user space fib. So you don't have to do anything particular, in quotes, let's say. But in our situation, as I explained, we wanted to be able to arbitrarily decide how to forward the traffic across the network. So what we decided to do is basically tagging traffic with an MPLS label at the edge, the segment routing style, let's say, and then write some OpenV switch rules or OpenFlow rules across the network to route traffic based on the ingress port and an MPLS label. We decided to use OpenV switch, which I'm sure everyone should know, which is this great open source project that implements a virtual switch. And it does it by offering northbound interface using OVSDB or using OpenFlow, or even using the, let's say, manual command line tools to configure rules, basically. OpenV switch has a very cool architecture because it does support thousands of rules or tens of thousands of rules, but it does micro caching. So as long as your traffic is realistically distributed, you won't have most of the time rules that are matching with the same probability every flow you configure in the system. So it is able to have thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of flows, in our case with line rate performances, as long as only few of them are matching or few thousand of them are matching, because they are cached in multiple layers in cache and in RAM.
The 6-wind binary that you're running on the various cores is really the data path for OpenV switch.
It is. But let me stress, this caching is also part of the vanilla OpenV switch that you can download from GitHub. Just in the case of the six-wing stack, we are doing it in a many-core way, in a massive parallel way on every core of the platform.
Okay, so you have OpenV switch, you have Linux, you have probably Quagga running on it.
Yes, we use Quagga for BGP and OSPF at the moment.
So how do you program the MPLS labeling and let's say segment routing then?
Yes, this is all done by using OpenFlow rules in OpenV switch. So basically, most of the customer traffic that arrives at the edge is PPP. We first clean up every other traffic and take the PPP traffic, make it go through a PPP daemon, which is a custom thing we used, then take that IP traffic and match it against a set of OpenV switch rules to understand what kind of traffic it is and split it roughly between QoS classes, let's say. Then take that traffic and tag it with an MPLS label, which depends on the site it is originating on, so the radio tower, let's say, and the class of traffic. And this gives globally unique MPLS label to each packet. And then basically for forwarding, we have a dynamically decided set of rules which matches the egress port, the class traffic, and the MPLS label. And based on this, it decides which egress interface to send the traffic to. And the interesting thing is the way we decide how to forward traffic is based on a custom algorithm we've wrote with researchers in two universities in Italy. And it is basically a mixed integer programming algorithm, which you can imagine it as a very large model of the current network topology and the current capacity of each link on the network. So we have this, imagine it as a black box sitting in the data center on multiple servers that you feed with the current network topology, the capacity of each link, the traffic demand at each link, and the traffic split between protocols or anyway, QoS categories. The output of this algorithm is a set of rules which basically reduces the number of overutilization of links. So as long as there are network paths, which may be not the shortest, but reduce the overall number of links which are used for more than 100% of the capacity, then it will pick these paths. And also for each of these paths, we automatically decide and pre-install a backup path, which is basically a secondary path that tries to be as different as it is possible from the main path. So then we have basically a fast reroute architecture in place where we monitor each link using BFT on a point-to-point manner. And if a link should fail, we redirect the traffic on the backup path immediately. So within a few hundred milliseconds, we are able to reroute the traffic on a backup path to one of the data centers. And this algorithm is running every time there is a change in the network topology. So every time a link goes up or down, but it is calculated in an incremental way. So we don't have to reprovision, of course, the whole OpenFlow rules all across the country, but we only do it on a specific network region. And also we run it periodically as well, because, you know, during the day and night, the traffic usage changes based on, you know, prime time, people watching Netflix, for example, or nighttime backups and so on.
Interesting. You've mentioned QoS multiple times. I'd like to ask you how you're implementing that on your platform.
Yeah, so keep in mind that our customers are at the moment mostly residential. And as you know, there are two big trends going on in the telco industry. One is the explosion of video traffic, which as a consequence brings to a much higher concentration of usage during prime time. So if you take a prime time usage of a residential ISP now, you will find that, I don't know, 70, 80% of the traffic that they are carrying is video, one-way video. I mean, YouTube or Netflix or so on, Amazon video, whatever. The average traffic grows much more during prime time than the average of the day. These two trends are really, in my opinion, destroying the residential telco industry because you are forced to plan for a much larger network than what you actually need in order to provide a decent service during prime time, or at least you should. This is the idea. This is nothing new, of course, but we are, as everyone else, noticing these trends. So keep in mind that our network topology is a very random mesh topology, very dense mesh, where each individual link has a very low latency, because it's a wireless point-to-point link, so it may have a half a millisecond latency per link. We are talking about one-way video. It's not very sensitive to latency increase or to jitter. So if you're willing to increase the latency of that part of traffic by even a couple of milliseconds or even a single millisecond, that means you can extend the path you are allowing the traffic to go through to maybe paths that are not the shortest, but they may be going through, I don't know, 2-3 hops more. So if you take this mathematically to the whole network, you have a much larger number of allowable paths across the country. Because you are not only using the strict shortest path algorithm, but you are using a shortest plus bound paths. So in our case, we basically mark the traffic very roughly at the edge. And this is a very opportunistic traffic identification. So we basically make tag all the traffic that we know it is video or we know it is belonging to ourselves with a lower class of service. And we tag it with some particular MPLS labels that have the significance of being lower priority traffic. So they may go through longer routes than the normal traffic. So what effectively we are doing is spreading out the load across the whole network.
That's a pretty interesting way to do it. And I think that that is something that isn't typically thought of in a traditional ISP service provider environment, because we as networking folks have been trained to think, I want the shortest path. I want the most optimal path, where the most optimal path might not actually be the shortest path. It might be the path that actually has the headroom to handle what's being requested of it. And you're right in that the video stuff, it doesn't really care about that, right? It's just, I just want to consume this. So it's all going to be inbound with outbound acts, right? So it doesn't care that this path has a higher cost and is a longer path. That's a really good way to spread bandwidth around. And not a lot of people think about that, I don't think.
It's not that. Even if you think about it, there is no way to implement it without having this centralized logic that they built. Because doing this in a distributed way is mission impossible.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that's driving a lot of the big service provider to start looking at stuff like this, because those last mile links are going to start consuming more and more and more inbound traffic. So to me, this seems like a pretty good idea and is likely driving at least partly the large consumer service providers to looking at some of this orchestration stuff.
Oh, by the way, Giacomo, one thing I wanted to ask you, how long did it take to write that controller software?
Let me say, beside the algorithm, in the controller, we also wrote a web user interface, which is basically used by our customer support, our network operation team. We defined also a grammar, basically a CLI grammar, which can be scripted and also includes some very basic language to do, for example, one-liner, do a command on all the interfaces, or, I don't know, extract some bits from an MPLS label and so on. So there is a small grammar. You define templates for each host and each interface type using this grammar, this language. And then what the controller is doing is basically assembling a configuration for a particular device and sending it out once the device goes online. So when the router is installed by the field engineer, the first time it goes online, it retrieves this configuration from the controller and parses it and basically connects to OSPF, BGP, retrieves the OpenFlow rules and so on. So there is a UI, a set of APIs, northbound that we designed, and also this grammar and the algorithm we describe. And this was the work of, well, currently it's the work of two people. So our team is just maybe less than an half a dozen people working on it right now. And it took overall like a year and a half. And I was the CTO of this company, of this internet provider. But after like a year being the CTO, I had 40 people under me. And I didn't want, you know, I don't want to be a manager. I want to play with things. So this whole project was done during a sabbatical. So basically I was begging my boss, why don't you give me a year? You pay me for a year and I will go off and build a router for you. So after a while I managed to convince him and this is the product.
Wow.
That's cool. That begs the question, how supportable is this? Obviously, you guys are using it in production, so you guys are supporting it. What kind of hurdles have you had to jump over to get around things like single controller, redundancy issues, that kind of long geographic spans.
Yes, the idea is that in case a given router cannot talk to the controller, the rules are not changing. So it's not an immediate concern. Well, it will be a concern over time, of course, in case Link should fail. But if you have a router that for any reason cannot talk to the controller or your controller is down at the moment, the network is still running, won't be able to react to second order problems. So in case there is a Link failure, there is already a backup, so you don't have to do anything. But if even the backup will fail, then your controller is needed. As you can understand, it's not an immediate concern. So scalability is much more relaxed. It is true that having a central authority is theoretically some sort of single point of failure. But keep in mind that in practice, we are talking about several servers in different data centers, and they don't even need to be online 100% of the time.
So you also have a distributed controller architecture.
Yes, it is all based on virtual machines, which are distributed in several data centers.
And probably linked with an eventually consistent database in the background.
Yes, and they use the APIs and a PKI to talk between them.
Why aren't you guys selling this?
Well, keep in mind that we built all this with a single use case in mind, with a single customer in mind. So productization is much simpler than what a vendor is doing. So I'm not claiming that we did anything better than a vendor will ever build, not at all. But my message is that if you are thinking of building something, even if you are not the largest provider, you know, we are not AT&T for sure, and we had a team of seriously 2-3 people working full time, you can do it nowadays, in my opinion. It's all about the team you have. So if you have a good R&D team and you have some software developer that understand networking and networkers that understand a bit of software development, you can do miracles, in my opinion, nowadays.
You've solved one of the hard problems, which is controller redundancy. That's very difficult to do. I agree with Yvonne. Why don't you guys try to productize this a little more? I think people would pay for it because you're solving hard problems.
Or at least open source it, because if someone is listening to this podcast now and he goes like, yeah, I want to do the same thing, he has to go through all the wheels and reinvent them again.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this is an idea we had since the beginning of open sourcing everything. At the moment, it's not at a stage where it could be picked up with someone else, I believe. For example, something we left a bit behind, as usual, is documentation. So we have to package everything in a way that can be used by others. And also regarding the algorithm we designed, we have in mind a couple of scientific papers we are going to publish on it, because it's itself is probably a contribution to the operating research community.
And so we are back to that same argument. My code is not beautiful enough to be shown around.
Yes, but it's not just a matter of pride one takes off your own code. It's, as I said, the fact that we didn't build it to be a product from the start. It is built to be something to base one business on. So if your network is completely different from us in topology, in protocol you want to support and so on, for sure it can be adapted, but you need a bit of guidance in what to change. That's the idea.
Yeah, but I think that a lot of very successful open source projects never started as a product.
Yeah, that's yeah. True. It will happen eventually.
I hope it will.
Yeah, I would love to see some of that code.
And the other funny thing we are doing right now, just for fun, is that our central controller right now is working on a couple of Xeon x86 boxes. Because a large part of that algorithm is basically solving some very well-known graph algorithm like Dijkstra, WellFarm4, and so on, we said, why don't we just buy a couple of GPUs, the NVIDIA Tesla, which are now a few hundred euros on eBay, and put them in our servers and rewrite that part of code using a GPU. So it's not in production yet, but we did write that part, and it's basically sub-second. So within a second, we can generate the topology and the backup topology for the whole country instead of going through, it's almost a minute using CPU.
Now this is getting crazier and crazier.
I know, right? No, this is really innovative. The problems that you're solving are problems that people have been working on since SDN, since before it was a thing. The one other question that I forgot to ask was, have you had any issues with pushing your OpenFlow stuff across high latency links or large geographic areas, or have you placed the controllers in locations where that's just been a non-issue?
So far, there hasn't been a problem. You push OpenFlow over SSL, over TCP, so lower layers are taking care of retransmissions. And anyway, latency isn't that great, even to the largest point. I think right now our network diameter is like 29 hops, so it's quite a large network. Mm-hmm. But despite that, it has been fine so far.
Cool.
Yeah, and if nothing else, these rules are pretty static. So if they arrive within a second, who cares?
Yeah, the amazing thing is we wrote a very simple user interface where you see a map of the network. And if you mouse over the links, you will see basically the paths that are going through that link. So which radio tower you are linking across that link. You are, reaching across that link. And the amazing thing is that if you don't do anything and if your network is stable and you do this, for example, in the afternoon and in the evening, you will see two different situations because the network would have rebalanced itself based on, for example, the traffic growth in prime time. So it's like the network is breathing in a way.
Not only did you build your own boxes, put together your own operating system, wrote your own distributed controller, wrote your own traffic management applications. You also built a usable network management system.
Usable, it's a big word, but it is being used right now by all the whole comp.
No, this is amazing.
Yeah, I'm taken aback. Because, all of the things that you've done are things that most people will do 2/3 of those and get to that point, that 80% where it's working and the people that wrote it and that need to support it can do it. But when you start talking about the monitoring pieces, that's where most of the, I can't say that's where most of the hard work comes from because you've clearly done a lot of hard work here, but that's where the supportability pieces come in and they really start to take shape because you can have the one guy that built it that really understands how to go and look at it, but then you're a production service provider, so you have to have a NOC that's going to have some tools that are going to show them red, green, essentially. Is it up or is it down? And having such a custom back end, you essentially have to write that yourself, right?
Yeah, but keep in mind that we are coming from a wireless ISP deployment, so wireless devices themselves, they have thousands or millions of knobs you have to monitor, small SMP OID that points you to the number of wireless retransmission or the noise on that frequency. So in the past, we already had built a platform that does basically continuous baselining. So it's a neural algorithm which tries to find anomalies autonomously in each of these parameters we acquire over SNMP from each radio. So the way we did it for this networking application was basically taking that platform and adapt it to monitor basically all the metrics from networking. And in this case, we have right now there are a lot of trends going on, for example, with gRPC from Google or all this kind of agent-based technologies to push back from the edge statistics. So this is what we do as well. So we have a small agent we've wrote, which is running on each router, which is periodically pushing back to the controller aggregated statistic about the traffic on each link or retransmissions and so on. So we already have aggregated statistic coming at the core.
So you're not just pulling traffic from your CPE, you're also pushing telemetry and other statistics from the POP nodes.
Yeah, we only push, actually.
We only push, okay. Push,
yes, because it wouldn't scale pulling.
I guess that makes sense. That must be just a monumental amount of data. Do you have problems with consuming that data and doing your analytics on it?
What we do is we basically rewrote the logic of MRTG, which probably many people will know is multi-tier database, basically, circular database, where we save with a high granularity the very recent past and with decreasing granularity the oldest past. And we try every time we aggregate data, as time passes by, we parse that data to find for anomalies. So we keep a very long history, which is not very detailed, but a very detailed history of the recent past.
Okay, that makes sense. this is kind of blowing my mind a little bit.
Not just a little bit.
Yeah, but keep in mind that we used a lot of very good pieces of software which are out there, like for example, OpenVSwitch I mentioned before, And this is, of course, stuff we didn't write from scratch, but we stand on the shoulder of giants, as we say.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I mean, you hear about these kind of things running in labs and very small deployments and very specialty type of environments, but you've thrown it out there and it's running a huge production service provider that covers an entire country.
Yep.
Okay, let's just wrap it up here before I get too depressed.
You shouldn't.
No, I'm thinking about all the hype out there and all the startups that are doing one of the things that you're doing and make all the noise and wait to be acquired. And there you are, a team of three people doing all these great things and no one knows about you.
Yep, that's right. But that's exactly, just to wrap up, the message I try to give every time I give a talk about this is that it is feasible right now to build things in-house. If you are a moderately large ISP or a middle-sized ISP and you have a decent team of good engineers, you can do miracles. You can build this thing in-house. The other lesson learned from this experience is that it is feasible right now, in my opinion, on generic traffic like the one we handle, to do software-only forwarding. So we don't use any ASIC. We don't have any ASIC on our boards. Everything we do is based on the six-win data plane. And this is purely CPU. So as long as you keep an eye on the CPU cycle you spend per packet so that you can calculate basically the throughput you will have on each port, you won't incur in basically dropping packets because your CPU is not fast enough. It is feasible nowadays to have line rate on 10 gigabit without any issue. Of course, things will be different probably if you have 100 gigs or 40 gigs on that interface, but with a different CPU, you can probably handle that amount of traffic as well.
Yeah, that's a different application though too, right? I mean, eventually that'll be what you're deploying out there, but that's probably a handful of years off for a consumer residential ISP.
Yes, but for a specific application like we do, it's probably already time for...
Ah, so you're already thinking about moving from 10 to 40 gig.
Well, the first trend we have is building another box which has more than two 10 gigabit interfaces, of course. Because at the moment, our pressure was to have many gigabit interfaces to connect several radio heads on each tower. But at the same time, we will probably need to build another new hardware revision with more than two 10 gigabit, probably like 8 or 16 or so.
Wow. Okay, Giacomo. If people want to know more about you and all the exciting things you're doing, how can they get in touch with you?
Probably the easiest way is to go to my personal webpage. There are all the links to the talk I give, and there will be a few other talks on this project coming soon. And that's minux.it, which is minux.it. And also my Twitter detail and email detail are there.
If people want to get in touch with you, they can just send you an email and ask you about the details?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, just drop me an email. If you have any idea of building this in your own network, get in touch.
Perfect. Thanks a million for this really inspiring conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Nick, where can people find you?
Well, probably I'll be sitting writing an email asking for more details about this exact subject. But if people want to get a hold of me, you know, I'm generally on Twitter at Baralio, or occasionally I'll blog at forwardingplane.net. I've been trying to do a little bit more of that lately. My contact information is all there.
Thank you, Giacomo. Thank you, Nick, for being with me today. I'm Ivan Pepelnik. You can find me at ipspace.net. Or you can go to sdn.ipspace.net where you'll find this podcast, links to other podcasts, blog posts, webinars, videos, books, you name it. And do keep in mind, we call this thing software defined, but even in Giacomo's case, it's running on CPU cores, so it's still running on hardware.